Hello everybody, this is Salil Tripathi from the Institute for Human Rights and Business, and I'm talking with Meghna Abraham, who is a lawyer and who is the head of the Economic and Social and Cultural Rights at Amnesty International, and who has worked with Seema Joshi on the report on companies that have invested in oil palm plantations in Indonesia, where there have been significant human rights abuses. Meghna, thank you for talking to us.
Thanks very much.
So my first question is really because Seema and I have been talking about this earlier. My first question is, what were the key findings that you found? And in particular, I'm interested in the impact on the gender-based impact. In particular, what was the impact on women workers?
Okay. Thanks very much, Salil. Yeah, we were frankly, I think Seema may have mentioned this, but we were frankly quite shocked by the scale and severity of the human rights abuses that we found. Uh-huh. And I would stress that we found these abuses not just on Wilmar's suppliers' plantations, mm-hmm. but actually on plantations that are owned by Wilmar's own subsidiaries. Uh-huh. And the range of abuse that we found, for example, we interviewed children, some children as young as 8. Some of the children have dropped out of school to help their parents.
Yes.
And a lot of this links to very systematic problems in the kind of working practices that Wilmar has on its plantations, and in fact also in its suppliers' plantations, where workers have to meet these really high targets. So,
yes.
For example, harvesters,
yeah.
who cultivate palm fruit have to cut down about 1,000 kilograms of fruit on a daily basis.
Right.
That's their target. So
right.
as you can imagine, that's a really high target. They have to do a whole bunch of other tasks along with it. The wages, the minimum wages are quite low.
Mm-hmm.
So effectively, they bring in their children to help them. They
yeah.
also get their wives to help them in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
And we found this pattern where the wives work as, they're employed as casual daily laborers. So essentially, they're in casual employment status. They don't have access to medical insurance. They don't have access to pensions.
Yes.
There's a loophole in Indonesian law which allows companies to hire people as casual daily laborers as long as they don't work more than 21 days a month
uh-huh.
for 3 consecutive months.
Right.
And so what Wilmar's subsidiaries and the suppliers are doing, most of them except one, they hire women, the wives of harvesters, in these casual employment contracts.
Mm-hmm.
They also hire some men, but mostly all the women that we interviewed are hired on these casual contracts. And in some cases, we interviewed some women who worked for these companies for as much as 20 years.
Right.
But they're still casual at the end of it. So they, at retirement, they have absolutely nothing to fall back on. So we interviewed a woman, for example, who had worked for the company for over 20 years. And at the end of it, she was left without a pension and is now making a living. She has to live with her children.
Mm-hmm.
She goes around collecting sticks to make brooms with. She's earning, you know, basically less than $6 in 2 weeks.
Right.
And that's how she's surviving.
Right.
So it's very systematic, the issues of discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a very severe issue that we found that women workers, who again, these casual workers, are the ones who are responsible for spraying all the
Yes,
the
I was just coming to that because I was told that, one of the things I'm told is that there's exposure to chemicals which are banned in the European Union.
Yes, so one of the chemicals that we focused on that came up quite a lot from the partners is the use of paraquat. So
mm-hmm.
I think, as you know, paraquat is banned for use in the European Union, but it is being used in Indonesia. But actually, even in Indonesian law, there's the requirement is that it's only trained and certified people who should be applying paraquat.
Uh-huh.
But we found that's absolutely not the case. It's just ordinary workers who are being asked to spray these chemicals,
mm-hmm.
and they do it with really very poorly equipped, so very bad protective equipment, or they're not given proper equipment when the equipment breaks down.
Have
so
there been injuries?
Found people,
have there been
sorry,
injuries?
Say that again?
Have there been injuries?
Sorry.
Yeah.
Yes, so we came across a number of people who had suffered injuries that after exposure to these chemicals. There's one woman in particular who was willing to speak publicly about her case, Johanna. Johanna worked as a foreman at a Wilmar supplier, and she was transporting Gramoxone, a paraquat-based
mm-hmm.
herbicide, and was splashed in the face while trying to carry these jerry cans of Gramoxone. There was real negligence in how her case was treated by the company, in our opinion, and in the end, she ended up suffering ocular damage, so corneal damage, as well as damage to her optic nerve.
Yes.
So she has very limited sight in one eye, and her other eye has also been affected.
Uh-huh.
But there were other cases of people who've suffered health issues, but are quite nervous about speaking about them, are also not fully diagnosed, and because of this issue of medical insurance, it's a very tricky situation for the workers to get the care they need.
How easy?
In addition to Paracort, we also found the presence of what the WHO classifies as class 1A and class 1B pesticides and chemicals, which are highly hazardous and extremely hazardous chemicals. Mm-hmm. And that's acknowledged actually on Wilmar's own subsidiaries plantations.
Mm-hmm. Now, how easy was it for you to approach and meet the workers? I mean, were they afraid? Were they fearful? Was there any threat from security guards?
The workers were definitely quite nervous. Mm-hmm. We know that, I mean, of course, Indonesian groups have highlighted these issues, but other groups who've tried in the past have highlighted that they've faced a lot of problems because the workers are very nervous about being able to talk. So we had done a lot of work with partners to think about how we could do this work. The first time we went, we were not even sure we would actually manage to interview workers.
Right.
So we built in a lot of safety precautions in terms of how we did it. We made sure, of course, as we tend to do in these situations, that all the interviews are anonymous. We've tried to build in safety protocols for the people we've interviewed. But yeah, they are extremely nervous about speaking about these issues. And so the first time we went, we interviewed some workers in Central Kalimantan. We then went back with the help of partners and interviewed more workers in North Sumatra and also in Central Kalimantan. And an issue where that really comes out is child labor, because people were quite nervous about talking about child labor because of fear that they'll lose their job if it's found out that they've talked about that.
Right. So one kind of broader question, taking a step back, because you've done several of these reports which look at the impact of multinational companies or even homegrown companies on communities in remote areas. I mean, I know Kalimantan is very, very far from Jakarta. And another example I have is, of course, the Muniwa case on which you have worked in Myanmar, which, of course, is a region which is very far from Yangon or Mandalay. So reflecting on that, my question is this, that now you, at least those two major amnesty reports I'm familiar with, what role do you see of Asian companies when they work in this kind of an area compared to what you might have known from other multinationals, such as Western ones? You have been talking to companies like Wilmar on one hand and in the Myanmar case with the Chinese company in that context, but you also obviously had to talk to Wilmar's customers, who are large multinational companies. So are you able to draw any conclusions from that?
I mean, I think speaking on the Myanmar case, I think as you know very well, Salil, actually, that case for us, it was very interesting to see that it had different stages, moved from a Canadian Myanmar government joint venture to then a Chinese and
it began with the Bulgarian one, actually. If you really go
and actually
back,
we felt the companies involved had been complicit in abuses. So it was not as though that the Chinese company had come in, Wanbao, and then only they had been involved in abuses and things had been different before that. I think for us, that is the lesson that I think in a way it's not so much, it's not about the nationality of the company. It's into a large extent the company's perception in that context of how far the laws are going to be enforced against them. That's, at least in my opinion, that's what makes the difference. I don't think it's so much just about the nationality of the company. In this case, Wilmar has engaged with us. Mm-hmm. They have been responsive. We've been trying to meet with them. As have, of course, as you can imagine, all the large buyers of Wilmar. We have had extensive engagement with all of them in terms of presenting our findings and asking them for responses. I mean, Wilmar is a very, very large company. So it's such a large agribusiness. And I think they have more experience of having been exposed to some of these issues on the environmental side.
Right. And one final question, therefore, is this, that you obviously, know the strengths and the limitations of instruments like the UN Guiding Principles on one hand, and on the other hand, ILO conventions, which also have some force, but often it is seen in normative terms. What could be the longer-term solution for situations of this kind?
I mean, I would take that at two levels, Salil. Thanks for asking that. I mean, one, I think for me, it's been quite striking in this for Amnesty, in this particular piece of research, that what we've seen is Indonesia generally has strong labor laws.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, a lot of the abuses that we've discovered under Indonesian law could potentially be criminal offenses.
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, this is not just a situation of we're coming in, we're just looking at it from the international standards perspective, which again, Indonesia is a party to most of the treaties, core treaties in this area, but it's actually under the international standards as well as Indonesian law itself. It's very clear that a lot of these practices we've seen, children working, forced labor, minimum wage, you know, all of these issues are not just illegal, but could potentially be criminal offenses. Mm-hmm. And this is where we see, this is a quite a shocking, in a way, finding for us, that despite that, these abuses are flourishing to the level that they are. So there's obviously a big issue here about enforcement, that Indonesia really needs to enforce its own laws vis-a-vis, mm-hmm. in this sector, of course, against fairly large and powerful companies. But the other side of it is also that I think we've seen, perhaps because this sector has come under so much scrutiny, all of these large consumer companies who buy from Wilmar are in the limelight. They have promised for years now that they have fixed the problems.
Yes.
They all have really strong policy documents. They all meet that particular, except for one, I think, of them, or two of them. They all have these policy statements in line with the UN guiding principles. But where the massive gap lies, mm-hmm. is in actually implementing that and transforming that to really concrete due diligence.
Right.
When we pitched them and said, have you identified, you know, the concrete risks, high risks of labor abuses that exist? If Amnesty can do this, then so can you. I mean, if you have high targets, if you have peace rates, if you have people in casual working environments, if you have dangerous chemicals, I mean, these are obvious risk factors for labor rights abuses. And when we pushed the companies and said, well, you are long-term customers, most of them have sourced from Wilmar for many years now.
Hmm.
Why haven't you identified these risk factors, let alone the actual abuses that we found? As Seema must have discussed with you, it's really people have not been able to give us a good answer.
Right.
What they have is policy commitments,
yes.
broad schemes, but not due diligence, which would actually identify, and no evidence that they've identified, very severe labor rights abuse and risk factors.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. This has been very illuminating, and good luck with your campaign, and all the best with your work.
Thank you very much, Salil. Thank you very much for having us on the podcast.